This is a special feature produced for download from ABC Classic FM's website. Due to copyright restrictions on the music, it's been edited to make this possible.
Hello there and welcome to the program. Margaret Throsby with the Midday Interview on ABC Classic FM. Imagine being able to hear people talk to you but being unable to understand a lot of what they say. Not being able to tell the difference between the boy chases the dog and the dog chases the boy. Unable to tell the time or follow the rules of a schoolyard game, living in a fog of incomprehension. But imagine at the same time having a powerful, near-total auditory and visual memory, able to hear the 6 o'clock news and then reproduce it word for word hours later, easily memorise whole books by visualising the sentences on the page. This is a glimpse inside the mind of Barbara Arrowsmith Young when she was a child. How Barbara transformed her brain by dint of unbelievable hard work and determination is extraordinary and gives hope to many children written off as afflicted with intractable learning disabilities. Barbara Arrowsmith Young is our guest today, and I wonder if music played a part in this story. Let's listen to her first music selection. Just a little taste there of the violin concerto by Sibelius, the exceptional violin playing of Ida Haendel with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, and chosen by our guest today, a visitor from Canada, Barbara Arrowsmith Young. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very
much. And welcome back to Australia.
Thank you.
Tell me about that. You asked specifically for Ida Haendel, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I saw her perform a few years ago in Toronto and also had read that Sibelius said she was the best interpreter of his violin concerto.
She must be getting on.
She must be somewhere in her 80s.
And you heard her a few years ago.
Yes, I did. And it was remarkable to see somebody with such vigor and passion for that piece. I mean, to me, that the piece has such passion and it feels very creative and almost like some of the struggle that I went through, but then the transformation at the end. I love that piece.
The struggle you went through, I'd like to take take us right back to the beginning, because I think that would be helpful for people to get a picture of who you are. Mm. Where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Toronto in 1951 in Canada, and my father was an engineer, and so we moved when I was five to Peterborough, a small town outside of Toronto, where the General Electric was and where he had his career. So I grew up in sort of small town Ontario. And even before entering school, I knew there were problems. I was very uncoordinated, almost like the whole left side of my body was alien and not connected to the rest of me. I was accident prone. My mother thought that I would be dead by the age of five because I was constantly banging into things, bumping into things.
Did they have things like sight and hearing tested?
They did, and there was nothing wrong with either my sight, with my hearing.
Did you have siblings?
I did. I have four brothers, two older and two younger.
So your mother and father were by now experienced parents. They had two children before you.
They did.
It wasn't like the first, you weren't sort of the first child that they had. So they could compare you, presumably, with your older brother's progress.
They absolutely could. And they knew, certainly my mother, because she was at home looking after the children, knew that there was something wrong that was of a concern. I mean, we spent a lot of time at the emergency department of the hospital, you know, where I got numerous stitches for accidents. And I had trouble registering sensation. So if I put my hand on a hot burner, the left side of my body, I knew that there was pain, but I didn't know where it was coming from. So I truly was a danger to myself.
So you had this this clumsiness or this uncoordinated thing. But what about the way you thought and the way you perceived the world? You say that you realized before you were five. Is that hindsight that you read, or do you think can you remember having thoughts, I feel different, I don't feel the same as my best friend or something?
Part of the challenge I had is I didn't have best friends because I had trouble understanding and comprehending. So it kept me isolated and alienated. But
when did you start speaking? Did your mother tell you?
I don't think there was any indication that I was slow in speaking. It was more interpreting and understanding. So people would ask me, you know, to do things, give me instructions. I mean, even, you know, how to play games. And I couldn't understand. It was almost like, I heard the words, but to attach meaning. So it was what I discovered later, the part of the brain that attaches meaning to language was very significantly
was missing.
Impaired.
So if your mother said to you, Barbara, put your coat on and we'll go outside, could you do that?
I would have to stop to think about what that meant, and I would have to take time to process it and understand it. So eventually I would.
What did your mother think? Did you have an adult conversation with her after all this was part of the past? Did she ever tell you what she was thinking about you at the time?
She was concerned. You know, she thought maybe I was a little slow, is that was her understanding, but, you know, with the hope that maybe I would catch up. I mean, and at that time, because this was in the 1950s, there wasn't even the concept of a learning disability. So children were identified either as, you know, average or slow. And I was early on kind of put in that category of being slow.
When did you start school? How old?
I was six when I started school.
Can you remember it?
Oh, I remember it very well.
Tell me what your memories are.
I remember hating it right from the beginning. I struggled with learning how to read, and I could see other children learning how to read. And very early in grade one, I learnt to make excuses to either spend a long time in the washroom, you know, to avoid the schoolwork, or pretend I was ill so I would be dismissed from class early. So all of those kind of avoidance strategies. But I could easily see that other people were other students were understanding what was just incomprehensible to me. I was put in the turtle reading group, which was the group that, you know, was very slow. I got the strap in grade one. I reversed
you
everything.
You got the strap for what?
For messy work. Because when I wrote, I reversed all my letters and all of my numbers. And when I added things, I would reverse what I was adding. I would reverse the answer. And the teacher really believed that I was doing this deliberately. And there was no way I was doing this deliberately. I couldn't help but do it. That's the way I saw the world, was sort of upside down and confused.
Is this a gross form of dyslexia that we're talking about here?
It's sort of probably a hybrid of what now people call auditory processing, because I didn't understand language in terms of what I heard. I didn't understand language in reading, and everything was reversed.
But you could speak.
I could speak. I didn't have a problem with...
you could formulate ideas and say, I need some sandwiches for my lunch and I'll put them in the box. I mean, you could make those sort of...
Yes, I could. But I was very quiet because I didn't understand a lot of what was going on around me. My strategy was not to really engage.
What did the teachers say to your parents?
In grade one, my teacher told my mother I had a mental block and that I would never learn like other children. And
did you hear her say that?
I did hear her say that.
Really?
And
not great, is it?
It wasn't. And in my mind, I mean, as a child and being quite literal, I really thought I had a block, a piece of wood, a cube in my head that was making learning difficult. And in a sense,
metaphorically, it was right.
it was right.
But isn't it amazing what children think when you say she's got a mental block? Mm-hmm. And the word block, you must have heard that a whole lot of times during childhood, because we play with blocks.
Yes.
And you imagined one of them sitting in your brain.
Yes, I conjured up the image.
Now, at the same time, you had a good memory.
Yes.
Tell me about that memory.
It was both a visual and an auditory memory, almost verbatim. I think I always had a good memory, and then I think I used that as a compensation, so I developed it even more so.
Could you really remember the news word for word?
Yes, I could. And I could end up, my strategy in terms of studying was I would lay out all my notebooks on my bed, and I would first kneel down and I would cry. I would just cry from the depths of my soul. And I think later on I realized I was probably draining the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that processes emotion, and studying brought up a lot of fear and terror. So I would just totally drain my emotional system. And then I would start with the first sentence in my book, and I would read it, close my eyes, visualize it, do the next sentence, read it, close my eyes, visualize it, match it to the first sentence. And by the end, it would take several hours, but I could start with the first sentence in the book and I could just go right to the last sentence.
So you'd regurgitate stuff.
I'd regurgitate, but I never understood. And the challenge was, if I was, you know, reading a question on an exam, first of all, I wasn't sure if I understood the question on the exam. And then, did I make the right match? Did I call up the right piece
of
information to put on the paper? And I could get 10%, I could get 90%.
I can imagine that working, because I was at school in the 50s and we did learn a lot by rote. And for instance, history, you know, write what you know about the Battle of Waterloo. Well, you could just take a great chunk of stuff from your book and just regurgitate. Although probably teachers must have thought, this sounds familiar, this sounds like it's straight out of the book, you know. But what about maths? Could you do mathematics?
Math was very, very difficult for me. And again, I would memorize the formulas, I would memorize the patterns, and hope, again, that I did a right match. So,
but could you, say, solve a quadratic equation? Could you, you know, given an equation at the top, could you solve something like that using logic or mathematical?
Not using logic, using visual memory. Like I would memorize all the different sort of templates of the formula or the patterns, and then you just plug in the different numbers into the pattern.
Did you finish secondary school?
I did. I finished high school.
By dint of
working. I mean, I would work before I went to school. I would work at lunchtime. I would work after I went to school. Basically, my life was school and working to just keep my head above water in school.
Terrific motivation there, isn't there?
Yes, I was driven.
Let me ask you to introduce this next piece, which is played by Angela Hewitt, who's a very well-known Canadian pianist, the Chopin Nocturne in B-flat minor. Yeah. Why did you choose this?
I think it is a very uplifting piece, and I think because in my life there was a lot of desperation and despair, I was drawn to pieces that were light and uplifting.
One of the Chopin Nocturnes, B-flat minor, opus 9, number 1, and it was played by the Canadian pianist Angela Hewitt, and the Canadian amazing woman Barbara Arrowsmith-Young is our guest today. And we've heard the story so far, from the beginnings to when you finally left school. There came a turning point, though, when you read a book. What was the book?
The book was The Man with a Shattered World, and it was written by the brilliant Russian neuropsychologist Alexander Luria. And it told the story of a Russian soldier, Zazetsky, who at the Battle of Smolensk in 1943 had a bullet wound to part of his brain. And when I read this story, it was like reading my life on the page.
Where'd you find the book? Did somebody give it to you?
Someone gave it to me. I was in graduate school studying psychology, and really really hitting the wall. I knew that I wasn't going to be successful and able to finish my degree. And I'd been talking to my professors saying there's something very wrong with me and nobody really believing there could be, because how could I have gotten to graduate school if I was struggling at this level? And it was a fellow student that had come across this book and said, this, you know, might be of interest to you. And it was life altering. I met a mind that was like mine. And I knew now I wasn't crazy. I knew the source of my problem was part of my brain that wasn't working. I knew I didn't have a bullet wound. But I knew that this is, you know, where the problem is.
How did you know which part of your brain wasn't working?
Because it was the part where he had the damage. It was in the left hemisphere. It's called the angular gyrus. And it's the part of the brain that takes all of the information and puts it together to attach meaning to it. So it's almost, if you think about a concept like a cat, this is the part of the brain that holds all the details, like that it's got fur, that it's a mammal, that it's nocturnal, that it's a carnivore, and it pulls all of those elements together to build that concept. Well, in my brain, none of those details came together to build any concept.
Do we know why your brain developed like that?
I don't know. I mean, there's certainly, research to suggest that some learning problems can be genetic, and there were some that I shared with my mother, and there were some that I shared with my father. This one I couldn't see anywhere in my family when I looked.
And that part of the brain you've just described is not to do with memory.
No, it's absolutely not to do with memory. It's conceptual understanding and grasp of concepts. It's like, you know how people get that aha, the click, the insight where all these pieces come together and you say, aha, that's what it means. There were no aha moments in my life. Nothing ever came together. And what happened was, not only was my world fragmented, but eventually my sense of self became very fragmented.
Your self-esteem must have been, I mean, did you have love affairs with, did you have boyfriends and friendships and, you know, girly things to do with girlfriends?
Very, very limited, because part of the problem with that area is because I didn't understand language well. I couldn't tell when somebody was being genuine, when they were being a con. I couldn't see the logical inconsistency. So I was vulnerable to con artists. Mm. So it was hard to really trust people because I didn't understand, what they were saying. So I was very socially isolated.
When you read the book, what did you do? What happened next?
First, it was a relief that now I knew the source of the problem. And the first piece that you have to do if you're trying to solve a problem is identify what the nature of the problem is. And around the same time, I came across the research of Mark Rosenzweig at Berkeley. And he was working with rats, and he really demonstrated neuroplasticity. And what he found is, if you put a group of rats in a very enriched environment with toys to play with, lots of stimulation, they were better learners. And then when he looked at their brains, they changed physiologically and functionally to support the learning. So they had more dendrites. Those are the branches that support neurotransmission. They had more neurotransmitters, more glia cells. The brain had physiologically changed as part of that stimulation. And he threw down a challenge in one of his articles saying, can we not apply this work to human learning? And I thought, humans must have at least as much neuroplasticity as rats, and hopefully more. And I thought, what do I have to lose other than time, which was already lost to me? So maybe I could create an exercise that would stimulate that part of my brain. And that was the beginning.
What exercise did you create?
I picked clocks because I had never been able to tell time. And Zazetsky, in his description, said after his damage, he lost the ability to tell time. And if we think about a clock, it's a relationship. You have to understand the relationship between the hour hand and the minute hand. And I couldn't process relationships.
Could you tell the time if you looked at a digital watch?
Yes, I could, because it's just reading.
So if it said 1:42,
I could read 1:40. I could read the numbers, but I didn't know what it meant.
But like, see the clock up there, you just couldn't look at an analog clock.
I couldn't read it. And I wouldn't understand that, that if it's 12:30, that means it's halfway through the hour. Like that, it didn't mean anything to me. And so the exercise that I created, it wasn't so much that I wanted to learn how to tell time, but I wanted to find a window into that part of the brain to work it, almost like, a physiotherapist isolating a muscle to work a muscle. And So I started with two-handed clocks. And
what, you made a cardboard?
Yes, on a piece of paper, drew it, and then would have a series of times, like 2:45, 1:17, 7:14, and I would draw them. And then I'd have to have somebody to check them because I wasn't accurate. Mm. And eventually, after hundreds of hours of doing this over and over again, I got accurate and I got very fast. And then I thought, I need more complexity. So I added a third hand, a second hand. And then I added a fourth hand, a fraction of a second, because I wanted to force my brain to process harder and harder and more complex relationships. And by the time I finished that exercise with the four hands, I knew my exercise or my experiment had worked. I could start to understand things. I had always wanted to read philosophy, and I had access to a philosophy library. And I remember pulling a book off the shelf, opening it to a page at random, reading the page and understanding it as I read it. And that had never happened in my life.
How long did you, because I've read in your book that you practiced for hours at a time. Mm-hmm. How did you do that? I mean, that surely that's a one way ticket to exhaustion, isn't it?
It was exhausting, but I'd come to a point in my life where I was contemplating suicide. I could not imagine how I could go on. I had really hit the wall in terms of any kind of forward movement. So I was desperate and I was driven, and it was like this was my lifeline.
Did you write everything else out of your life? Then?
I did. I would get up in the morning and do this exercise. Have lunch, continue it, basically fall into bed, get up the next morning.
And that meant you had to have somebody checking you all the time to see whether what you were doing was you were getting a ride.
Yes. I had a friend that would look at the times and the clock faces that I had
written.
How
did you do it? You had a round face, and did you write down 1:17?
Yes, and then I would have to draw it.
You have to
draw
it.
Yeah, I had to draw it and get faster and faster at being able to do that, and more accurate.
And just by doing that?
Yes.
Just by doing that. So it's like, I can see relationships between that and exercising your muscles like a physiotherapist, as you say. If you have an injury, then you exercise the muscle till it gets stronger and stronger. And the more you do the exercises, the stronger it gets. Same story?
It's exactly the same concept. And it was just working that part of my brain over and over and over again to make it get accurate and fast at seeing those relationships.
I can't quite understand how, I can see how you could get good at telling the time, but that it actually, you can extrapolate from that you could actually then understand other things as well.
Because it was exercising that part of the brain. I mean, that is what that part of the brain does, is process relationships. And this is just was one way to force that part to work over and over and over again.
It's incredible. So what happened then? Because that was, how long did you do that for?
It was probably around, I'd say, 3 to 4 months, where I had the breakthrough that I could listen to things, read things, understand. I could listen to a conversation, understand it as people were talking to me before I would have to memorize the conversations and play them over for 2, 3, 4 hours to try to figure out what people were saying. Now I could listen as they were speaking, and it was so much more efficient.
It's pretty amazing stuff, isn't it? Do you think having a brilliant memory supported this in some way?
I don't think in terms of this. I think the memory was a compensation. It was what allowed me to get this far in school. But I don't think it supported me in terms of creating these kind of programs.
More music, please. And this time it's the Brahms Violin Concerto. Mm. Why?
There wasn't a lot of music in my house growing up, but there was the Brahms Violin Concerto, and my father loved this piece. So it reminds me of my father.
Thank you. final movement of the Brahms Violin Concerto. Gidon Kremer was the violinist with the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein and chosen by our guest, Barbara Arrowsmith-Young, who's visiting from Canada again. She's been a couple of times now, talking about the extraordinary life story. Just tell me this. You spent a few months doing it, or these exercises, intensively, like a mad thing.
Yes.
And then you had the breakthrough when you realised that you were beginning to understand what was written on the page and things were beginning to change. Did you have to continue doing the exercises like physios say, do the exercise for your arm and it'll get stronger, but if you let the arm go, it'll waste away again? Do you have to keep doing these exercises?
No. What is interesting is, even though we use the analogy of the brain like a muscle, it really doesn't work like a muscle. And what I believe happens is once the cognitive function is working, or that part of the brain is working, it starts to get its own stimulation by being worked within the neural network of other areas that all come together. And practically what I've seen, I've tracked people over 30 years out of the program, and there's no drop-off of function. Oh. So,
With this breakthrough with your brain, did the clumsiness reduce?
That was a different area, and I created another exercise for that. So after I saw that this worked, and I was living proof of human neuroplasticity now, I thought, maybe I can create an exercise for these two other areas, the clumsiness one, and then I had a spatial problem where I would get lost in people's houses. I couldn't create maps. Crossing the street was terrifying because I couldn't create a map of how far away the car was. So for the clumsiness part, it was an area in the right hemisphere, the somatosensory cortex, that registers sensation. I knew I had to create an exercise with my eyes closed, making very fine movements. So I couldn't see the movements, but I had to feel the movements. And I eventually got to be as accurate drawing very complex figures with my left hand, because it was the right part of my brain. So those figures, I could do them as well with my eyes closed as with my eyes open. And sure enough, it addressed that part, because now I don't bang into things on the left side of my body. I don't drop things out of that hand. I don't, burn my hand.
Can you drive a car?
I can drive a car. I mean, and I did drive a car when I had the problem, and you could see by extension the whole left side of my car was dented. I mean, my left side of my body was bruised. The left side of my car was dented because I, by extension, I didn't know where it was.
You
in
kept
space.
Misjudging things.
I would misjudge.
Yeah.
So I worked on that area and addressed it, and then the spatial area and addressed that.
Were you examined by scientists?
And not at that time, no. I mean, I wasn't. It was really my own journey of self-discovery. Mm. And even at that time, because this was in the late 70s, early 80s, there wasn't a concept that learning disorders had their source in parts of the brain that weren't working. I mean, now we do understand that. So at the time, there was really nobody that was exploring that territory.
What did your parents think of all of this?
Well, by this time, I had moved away from home, so they weren't really all that aware. It was probably several years later that I kind of shared my journey and the struggle and the real pain, because I kept it hidden. I mean, as people with learning problems do, they feel a lot of shame and they want to cover over and pretend everything is fine. They don't want to worry their parents. So, I memorized everything and it looked like everything was fine. So many years later, they had a lot of regret that they didn't know the degree of pain that
suffering
that I had gone through.
Really suffering. So then you've opened a school. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. In 1980, I opened a school for people with learning problems in Toronto, because I wanted to make these kind of cognitive programs accessible to other people. And over time, kept investigating and eventually developed programs for 19 different cognitive areas, from verbal memory, the things that I was good at, auditory memory, nonverbal reading, like the person that can't read, social cues. So a number of different areas that impact people, not just in school, but also in everyday life. And probably, I think it was 1997, decided I wanted to train teachers and bring this program into other schools. And currently have the program in 40 schools in North America and are just coming into Australia. And
have there been peer-reviewed studies published in reputable journals of this? I mean, have scientists followed one child who presents with difficulties in an area, followed them through the program and seen what the results have been?
We've done, I think, in total 10 studies from 1997 to 2007, and using a number of different research designs. Two of them were done with a professor at the Ontario Institute of Studies in Education, and they were presented as poster sessions at the American Psychological Association Convention, one in San Francisco and one in Washington.
Have any of the studies been at arm's length from you, though? Have people done them completely independently of you?
There was one that was done in the Toronto Catholic District School Board, and that was done independently, and they showed improvement in working memory, processing speed, phonological processing, and these were students that were engaged in cognitive exercises. They weren't doing academics. Another thing we found was rate of learning improved. So a lot of students with learning problems are learning about half a year per year. It's pretty standard. And what we found is 1 year and 2 years into the program, these students started learning either a year for a year or 1.5 of a year for a year, so doubling or tripling their rate of learning. I'd like to do more research. I'm always interested in research.
What sort of exercises do they do? I mean, what do the exercises consist of?
For the child that has trouble reading, recognizing the visual patterns in reading, what would be traditionally dyslexia, I have a program where I've taken, I think, 44 different languages, Telugu, Sinhalese, Burmese, and it's a computer-based program where the student will start with one symbol from a language that they're not familiar with. They have to look at it, visualize it, try to memorize it, and then find it in an array of symbols. And eventually they get up to 8 Chinese characters. And once they can visually hold and retain 8 Chinese characters, the whole capacity of the brain, what one researcher calls the brain's letterbox, I call it symbol recognition, but to learn visual template patterns improve. So they can learn spelling patterns, they can learn patterns for reading. And we use foreign languages because we don't want them to compensate by putting sound to it, by putting meaning. We want to work on that part of the brain in the left hemisphere that just recognizes patterns.
Can we listen to this? This is lovely music. Dvorak, the New World Symphony. Tell me about this.
Yes. I think it for me, it represents my transformation and the transformation of all the students that I've worked with. It's bringing them into a new world and a new way of perceiving.
Music from the Symphony No. 9 from the New World by Dvorak, the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra. Nicholas Harnoncourt was conducting. Barbara Arrowsmith-Young asked for that. Are there still gaps in your cognitive processing, Barbara?
There's one area that I didn't address, but it just means that I'm not good at learning foreign languages. So I have a program for it, but I just chose not to spend time working on that because I don't feel that it's a limitation. But other than that, in terms of the areas that I worked on, no. I mean, I can understand, I can process, I can reason, I'm coordinated, I can create maps in my head. In fact, I don't like using a GPS because I actually like reading maps now.
Do you still sort of think about doing exercises for your brain? I mean, they tell us that as we get older, we should do crosswords and, you know, keep our brains active. Do you agree with that?
I do, absolutely. And I do every once in a while think about it because I have access to the cognitive exercises I've built. And at some point probably will do something just for that cognitive decline that we all experience as we age. I mean, it's important to keep our brain active.
What brings you to Australia?
I am here now. The program is going into a school in the Catholic Education Office, Sydney, and it will be for students in years 9 and 10. So I'm here to talk to educators and also to present the work.
Is it for students with learning difficulties or students generally?
It's for students with learning difficulties.
Okay, okay. So what's your message to people listening then?
My message is that if we have a learning difficulty, we don't necessarily have to live with that. What I was told when I started grade one in 1957, that I better just learn to accept my limitations, that this was going to be a lifelong condition, that we now know that the brain is plastic. We know that the brain can change. We need to sort of all work together to find the right ways to harness neuroplasticity to make a difference in these children's lives and not sort of condemn them to having to live with these struggles.
And if you're a teacher, don't say in front of the child, your child's got a mental block. Oh, that's amazing. Let's finish now with your last choice, which is the first movement of the Italian Symphony by Mendelssohn. Mm. Tell me about this.
I think I like this just because it's so light and uplifting and hopeful.
Of the first movement of the Italian Symphony of Mendelssohn, and it was played by the London Symphony, conducted by Claudio Abbado, and chosen by our guest Barbara Arrowsmith-Young. Arrowsmith-Young hyphenated, and the book that she's written is called The Woman Who Changed Her Brain. Now tomorrow we're talking to Damien Barbalo. We met him earlier in the year. He was one of the featured composers at the Four Winds Festival at Easter in Bermagui, and we'll be hearing that interview again tomorrow morning at the usual time. Just quickly looking at next week, Michael Palin will be in on Monday. He has two new books out. One's called Brazil. It's about his journeys in that country. It ties up with his 4-part television series Brazil, which is airing on ABC One starting on Sunday. And in July, he released The Truth, his second novel. So Michael Palin joins us on Monday. Looking forward to that. Paul Daly on Tuesday. He's an author and journalist. He's written a book called Canberra, the next in the series published by New South on Australia's capital cities. And on Thursday next week, Colin Peasley, Australian Ballet's longest-serving member, having joined its foundation in 1962. As I said, Damien has a concert from Four Winds for you right after the news, and that's following now. I'll talk to you tomorrow. It's one.
This feature was produced by ABC Classic FM. You'll find more audio of our programs, along with special features for download, on our website at abc.net.au/classic/audio.